welcome to Change Surfer Radio. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of our radically democratic future. Speaking with Eric Davis, he's a writer. He lives in San Francisco. His senior thesis was on Philip K. Dick. He's written for Art Byte, Book Form, Wired. He's a contributor to Wired. And he's starting a column on Feed Magazine, an online magazine called Posthuman Condition. Welcome, Eric.
Hey, thanks.
And I'm particularly glad to have you because we share a common association with Mark Derry, who's been on this show twice, and he apparently requested the essay for a collection that he put out that inspired your current book called Technosis, and the essay that you wrote for that was Technosis, correct?
Yeah.
And it's very fascinating to me what you've done here, because most of the popular discussion around religion and the web, or religion and cyberculture, stops at the level that there's, you know, 30,000 websites on doctrines and faiths in Yahoo. The Spanish Catholic Order has just proposed this week that there be a patron saint of the internet. So some people talk about that in the web, but very little discussion has been given to kind of the deeper Gnostic significance of cyberculture. And your book, Technosis, which has come out this year, is a very interesting reflection on that. So I'm really glad to have you with us.
Yeah, no.
In your book, one of the things that you touch on, which is so fascinating, is the fact that electricity, had the etheric communication and the concept of electricity and vital energy has been a constant theme throughout spiritual life. Can you just say a little bit about how that has it lays the groundwork for our current cyber culture?
Sure. I mean, well, one of the overall goals of my book was to refute the notion that technology has always just been about utility and getting things done in a more rationalistic way, and that if you really want to understand some of the spiritual and religious impulses in the contemporary technological landscape, including ideas about the World Wide Web, but also, you know, notions of cyborgs and technological transcendence, uploading ourselves into computers, all of these various sort of weird science fictional ideas grow out of a long-standing underground set of ideas and practices that have always been with us in the modern world. I mean, I mostly concentrate on the modern world and in the scientific, post-scientific age. And in that age, the first really huge explosion of this kind of stuff really grows up around electricity. It's sort of no accident if you take a kind of synchronistic view of history. You know, certain things emerge at a certain time. They become deeper archetypes, deeper symbols for larger historical forces, which is sometimes an interesting way of looking at things, is that, you know, electricity really arose with the Enlightenment, the post-Enlightenment, with the modern world. And yet, it was always shrouded, certainly from the beginning, in all sorts of associations with alchemy, with the spirit of animism. They thought this was the secret of life. You know, after all, if you think about the most striking natural expression of electricity are the thunderbolts from the sky with all of that mythological resonance. So there's something very deep and profound about beginning to tame and explore the world of electricity. It's also that the world of electricity is incredibly bizarre. We're totally used to it because we've grown up with it and we, you know, rely on it all, you know, every day, all the time. And yet if you actually start to think about the science of electricity, it's quite unusual. I mean, it certainly, you know, puts some quantum mechanics in a, you know, run for the money for overall weirdness. Yeah. So when people first started to figure this stuff out, it took on much larger significance, and they started to project or discover all sorts of deeper or archetypal, mythological, religious ideas through the medium of electricity, through the idea that electricity was the secret of life, that it was what God used in order to spark creation, and these kinds of notions. And that was sort of one of the basic ideas that I have in my book, is that every time you have new scientific discoveries, new technological discoveries, even though these things are created in the rationalistic mind frame, because they open up new perspectives, new unknowns, ambiguous ideas, that people start to use them and project them and find things that are much deeper and stranger than you would think from the get-go.
You know, my bachelor's thesis was on Pentecostalism, and I did some observation in Pentecostal churches. One of the things Pentecostals do when they pray or chant, speak in tongues, is they have their hands in the air and they slowly kind of rotate them back and forth like radio telescopes. It always struck me that they were kind of like picking up signals from God.
Oh, very much so. There's a whole section in my book about Pentecostalism and the relationship of the particular form of spiritual ecstasy that is developed within Pentecostalism and media. It's no accident to my mind that it's been Pentecostalism in the history of the 20th century American Christianity that has most thoroughly, richly, and sometimes absurdly embraced not only the television and radio as a vehicle, but actually as symbols and ideas for this new kind of spiritual relationship. I remember the first time I heard glossolalia on a crackly AM radio when I was driving, you know, as a kid somewhere, and it was incredibly haunting. And yet, there's something about that the infectious quality of Pentecostal ecstasy that's perfectly tuned to the landscape of 20th century media. It's no accident, again, that Pentecostalism really begins at the very beginning of the century as the new technologies and the new media landscapes create new opportunities for experience and subjectivity.
Mm-hmm. So that's the medium, and then the message is also deeply rich with symbolism. You talk a lot about what is gnosis? You know, your book is the title of your book is Tech, G-N-O-S-I-S, gnosis. Can you just tell us what gnosis means?
Right. Well, it's a complex term. In its essence, it means a kind of spiritual or mystical knowing. So it has an emphasis both on knowledge in the sense of understanding the deeper level of reality, but it's also very mystical. It's not just knowledge like, you know, understanding how, you know, mechanics work or something. It's a deeper kind of cosmological, mystical knowledge. And it specifically refers to a sort of underground strand of Western religion, particularly Christianity, that emphasized the individual and mystical experience of knowledge of the divine over and against rites and dogma and the sort of institutional orthodoxy. So it was always a kind of heretical or bad boy strain within Christian religion. And one of the things that Gnostics, in a way, they're a very mixed bag. In some sense, it represents one of the pure lines of genuine mysticism in the West, the kind of thing that people often look for in Buddhism or in Hinduism, that kind of direct spiritual understanding. It was carried through in a lot of complex ways through these various underground streams that emerge from the Gnostic tradition. On the other hand, if you look at a lot of certainly the traditional Gnostics in the ancient world, you know, in the sort of last few centuries of the Roman Empire, at the beginning of Christendom, a lot of them were extremely dualistic. Extremely dualistic. They drew this intense divide between the material world and the spiritual world, much more so than what we think of even as Christianity, conventionally having a little problem with the mind-body distinction. These guys looked at the material world as a kind of prison, and that it was only through knowledge of the essence that you could escape to this incorporeal realm, and that we actually weren't our bodies. We were these little mystical sparks that were deep inside of us.
Now, this is a theme that Mark Derry has picked up and amplified, the body loathing on the part of most people in the cyberculture, which I confess I share it to some extent, the notion that we can escape from the meat puppet and transcend into some etheric existence.
Very much so, and that was really the connection I'm drawing to some degree, although I also see some positive and interesting signs of this desire for mystical understanding in the context of a technological civilization. But one of the things that was most important for me to emphasize was that kind of dualism that you see in cyberculture, that kind of loathing of the body, the idea that we can upload ourselves into a computer at the most extreme, or even just that it's through a virtual experience that we will discover ourselves, explore ourselves, and that desire to escape the limitations of the body, of the material world, has a deep psychological and religious kind of mind frame behind it, even though it might look purely secular. It's actually infused with these kinds of passions. Derry is very critical of, you know, of this tendency, and for very good reasons. But for me, it was a little bit more interesting to try to understand really what its deeper appeal was, and whether you can actually harness some of that energy and put it to better use, rather than simply kind of look at it as this ridiculous juvenile, attempt to escape, which on some degree it is. But I think there's also deeper, more interesting reasons, because we, in some sense, we've always been, you know, communing with virtual worlds, you know, the worlds of mythology and religion have always had this element of otherworldliness, or at least, you know, for a couple thousand years. What is that? What is this draw towards the otherworldly, towards the cosmic, towards the disembodied, the incorporeal? Where does that come from? Why does it keep coming up over and over again, even if we live in this material age? I mean, that's the great paradox of cyberspace, is suddenly we're all talking about all this sort of virtual worlds, all of these, you know, and they're, you know, you look at the way video games are going, you look at online three-dimensional worlds, you look at the alternative identities that people have, at the time some people spend in here, and it's clearly like people are really just living into greater and greater degrees in these incredibly elaborate, consuming environments that are essentially incorporeal. And yet, you know, we're this quote-unquote materialistic civilization. We don't believe in, you know, otherworldly journeys. We don't believe in the astral plane. We don't believe in any of this stuff anymore. And yet we've almost kind of reproduced it, but in a technological and in some ways more material way, since we can all share the same video game world. It's not just a world of the imagination or the internal, archetypal visionary capacity within us. So it's an interesting paradox.
Mm. Now, Americans are particularly prone, and you have a chapter about the American, the deep roots of techno-transcendence, techno-utopianism in American culture. What is it? Is it our libertarianism? Is it the fact that we were free from feudal constraints? What was it about American culture?
That's a very interesting question, because in many ways, a lot of the things that I describe in the book are very American. There's a number of aspects to this, one of which is just that we were the land of technological utopianism. In the 19th century, this country was just aflame with the idea that through science, through technology, and to some extent through politics, you could actually build a much better world, if not a real paradise. And so the idea, you know, in many ways, the United States was founded with this kind of almost alchemical dream of building a new Jerusalem. It was this quote-unquote virgin land. Of course, it wasn't actually a virgin land because there were people here, but leaving that little sticky issue aside, to a lot of the people who came over here, it was this sort of tabula rasa upon which we could write a new world, a new post-medieval world of industry and self-expression. And that kind of enthusiasm really began to commingle with technology in the 19th century. So this was really the land of progress. And we still have those ideas very deeply embedded in us. So even after all of the nightmares of the 20th century, we're still, there's a kind of part of us that when we see some new technological possibility arise, some new gizmo, some new scientific discovery, it's like, well, there's this sort of sense that it's going to lead to a better world. We don't have the cynicism ingrained in us that many other parts of the world do. So that's one aspect to it. But another one is what you mentioned, that this libertarian strain, this drive towards freedom, the drive towards the idea that the self, in its own exploration of its own powers and capacities, has the ability to know and experience itself to the deepest, that it's not necessarily through large social institutions, through defined historical identities, through roots in traditions and roots in social organizations that we really find ourselves. We find ourselves in our freedom. So that idea, that intoxicating idea of freedom, is very, very American. And there's something about the fusion of these libertarian impulses and these technological impulses that really helps explain why there's so much of America is still so intoxicated by this idea that technology will bring us freedom. And what I do in Technosis is sort of peel back the layers of that and show how it has specific spiritual and religious sources in it, that America has always been a deeply religious country, though not a traditionally religious country. And so it's really understanding that peculiar quality of American religion that I think undergirds a lot of this technological enthusiasm, even if on the surface it looks rather secular.
And one of the things that you talk about is how Americans in particular, but in general, there's a trend towards the integration of science. I mean, you talked earlier about about alchemy as a spiritual discipline and some Gnostic traditions that had kind of sciences at their core. But now we have the fusion of actual science, of Western science, with spiritual traditions as disciplines. And so, for instance, Scientology is something you give some attention to. Is that Scientology kind of an archetypal 20th century religion in that it has a spiritual biofeedback, basically, as one of its key spiritual disciplines?
Yeah, yes, very much so. I think Scientology rewards a great deal of attention. I mean, it gets a lot of flack for some of the policies of the church and some of the ways they've treated its detractors or critics on the outside. It's been quite a nasty beast in a lot of ways.
Doesn't make very good movies either.
Doesn't make very good movies, but at its core, it touches on some very basic elements of 20th century technologically savvy, scientifically savvy to some degree, religion, or at least in terms of trying to bring together contemporary ideas with spiritual or at least psycho-spiritual growth. And the basic idea that's integrated, which I talk about in my chapter, The Spiritual Cyborg, is that in some ways we are machines. In some ways, the behavioralists were right. That we are programmed by various patterns and habits. We run tapes in our psychologies over and over again. And that part of spiritual growth is to become aware of the ways in which we are very automatic, or the ways in which we are very robot-like. And these are all contemporary metaphors for something that's much older, including metaphors that you can actually tie to certain things in Gnostic traditions. But by rephrasing them in terms of programming, tapes, computers, machines, all of this sort of contemporary language, we begin to take advantage of the technological metaphors and ideas that are around us in order to do something that's very spiritual. You see this throughout the New Age. Much of the New Age is driven by the sort of idea or image of ourselves as being a kind of programmable machine, except that you start to understand the programming. You decondition yourself from habits and ideas that prevent your full flowering, and you begin to control or direct or guide your growth towards greater degrees of freedom. At its heart, Scientology is deeply, deeply Gnostic, and yet it expresses this Gnostic impulse in this sort of science fiction. It's not real science exactly, but it's sort of a science fictional domain that does have some very practical, pragmatic techniques at its heart. And those techniques, a lot of contemporary spirituality, especially, again, more towards the New Age, is about technique. But even the explosion of interest in yoga and Buddhism, which has characterized the last 30 years, 40 years of the American countercultural landscape and increasingly less countercultural, a lot of that is driven by the idea that at its core these traditions offer you techniques which allow you to actually experience things directly and change. You're not just buying a dogma that's going to explain the world anew to you. You're learning tools that you can express, and that through using those tools, you begin to change.
I'm an old Buddha Unitarian by background, and I first got involved in Tibetan Buddhism. And one of the things that got me to kind of disengage from Tibetan Buddhism and drift into a non-denominational Buddha Unitarian space was that the Tibetan Buddhists who first have come to this country, they're still carrying all this cultural baggage in the symbolism that they they use. And the techniques that they're teaching are very much techniques that are designed to do specific things with specific emotions and manipulate specific parts of your mind, but they're using thousand-year-old Tibetan images. And so, you know, one of the debates that's going on in American Buddhism is just what you're saying, is how do we contextualize and create American imageries that are specific to the mentalities that we're trying to change here, the cultural archetypes that we're trying to deal with here.
Right. And I think very much that American Buddhism is growing towards, and it's a tricky road. There's some real pitfalls along the way, but it's growing towards the most sophisticated kind of integration of that sort of scientifically informed psychology with these ancient techniques. I mean, I think it's one of the reasons for the appeal of Buddhism amongst many sort of educated, technologically informed people in our culture is that its models resonate with some of these ideas that we've developed by being deeply, sort of technological people, even though it tries to, in many ways, supplant the aridness and alienation of our consumerist lives. It also accords in some ways with a very non-theological way of understanding the self, and again with a great deal of emphasis on techniques that you actually can employ.
Mm-hmm. Which there's also strong overlap in cyberculture with the pagan stuff. You've written about techno-paganism and the overlap with hippie culture and The Well and Coevolution Quarterly, Kevin Kelly going from being editor of Coevolution Quarterly to being the founding editor of Wired and so forth. Where is the resonance there? Is it an ab reaction to technology that hippies somehow have gotten involved in this stuff, that pagans are so attracted to the web? Or is it the anonymity for alternative and minority religions that they've been attracted to?
I think in this case it's a specifically historical phenomenon in that some of the libertarian aspect of hippie culture found an early niche in computing, and it just, the fact that a lot of it grew up around the Bay Area, it was informed with a certain can-do individualism that was part of the counterculture, and so you, from that point, you had all this sort of hippie overlay, and along with that came a certain kind of interest in these sort of magical or psychedelic ways of looking at the world. It's also the case that a lot of computer programmers now, probably less so than before, but certainly in the 60s and or certainly in the 70s, were science fiction geeks and fantasy fans. And a lot of science fiction geeks and fantasy fans get into pagan ideas. They might not take it so seriously, but some of them take it more seriously. And so you have this kind of cultural environment where there's a relationship between the imagination and the idea of using technology, which in some ways is what magic is. Magic is really affirming in as sort of realized a way as possible the realm of the imagination, the realm of gods, of images, of fantastic landscapes, of psychedelic visions, and then having the idea that there are tools and techniques you can use to manipulate this environment and to create new experiences, explore new things. And so there's a real resonance there between that and the idea of building a virtual world.
A lot of the fantasy role-playing games that people play on the web have pagan overlays to them.
Oh, very much so, and that's actually one of the ways that people come to start actually manifesting this stuff or to start taking it more seriously. And then I think it also, for a lot of people who live that techno-pagan lifestyle, it is a way of balancing out the more soulless, disembodied, utilitarian, button-down aspects of technology, which certainly aren't going away. So it becomes a way of kind of having your foot in both worlds. It's a very dynamic place.
Now, one of the things that William Gibson did when he wrote his books about cyberspace, the prophesied cyberspace in the 80s, is he proposed that the kind of amorphous artificial intelligences that might develop out there in the web or in cyberspace might manifest to us as gods or take on the characteristics of gods to us. Is there a kind of popular notion now that that the web has a personality, or that there may be personalities, you know, greater than human personalities out there? I see a lot of it in science fiction.
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge idea in science fiction. I don't believe it's that strong in the popular culture yet because we haven't seen it, mm-hmm. but it's coming. And the reason it's going to come is that one of the things that will happen over the next 10, 20 years is the development of increasingly sophisticated, increasingly interactive, increasingly attractive artificial agents. That you will have characters, let's say they're on your screen, that have a certain personality, that look a certain way, that become popular the way that pop stars or movie stars become popular. Maybe they're animated so they look like, you know, like the popularity of Lara Croft in the Tomb Raider series, that kind of thing, except taken much, much farther as they begin to have a great deal of intelligence, as they begin to sort of become your ally, as you sift through the world of information. Maybe we have personal avatars, but then there will also be these sort of avatars that speak for larger kinds of collections of data and information, because it's a very handy way of interfacing with data in the popular mind. I mean, people don't like computers. They don't like, you know, line interfaces or whatever. They don't like having to type in commands. So the drive towards creating very easily interactive kinds of, you know, pop characters that will interface with data is going to drive the development of these things.
So instead of going to the Apple website, we'll go to the person, the avatar at the Apple website.
Exactly.
And we'll see the same face every time, and we'll ask them a question and it'll answer and it'll seem like a person.
Exactly. But then as that kind of stuff starts growing, then people will start to form psychological relationships with these things, the way that kids form psychological relationships with toys, or people form psychological relations with pop stars that they really like, except they'll be very interactive. They'll be part of our lives. And once you get that environment going, then it's to me, without question, that at least some portion of the population will begin to have more opportunity to start thinking like, well, maybe this is how the network itself becomes intelligent. Maybe this is how the network itself becomes alive. And as soon as we start to hand over more and more activity to the internet, as it becomes more and more autonomous, as we begin to trust technology and software to make more decisions, which is one thing that is going to happen, though it's quite frightening in many ways, that as it becomes more coming to us with information like, hey there, Bob, I know you like this kind of thing. Well, check this out over here. And you're like, oh, yeah, that is actually kind of cool. The more that it starts to display those kinds of autonomous behaviors, then again, the more easy it will be to start to perceive it as if it actually were autonomous. And I have no doubt that at some point something will happen that people go, who did that? Where did that come from?
And once you get that emergent property.
What's that?
An emergent property coming
out. An emergent property, exactly. I mean, mm-hmm. I think the great example of this, and a number of people have spoken about it, but it's still to my mind, is when Kasparov was playing Deep Blue. You know, I guess it's the third game where the computer won. And, you know, basically Kasparov experiences himself as playing against a machine. He knows he's playing against a machine that's like running through all of these various possible moves and is very good at it, and so it's a very challenging opponent, but it's basically playing against a big algorithm, or, you know, a meta-algorithm. But then there was at this point in the third game where he got flustered, where the program did something. And at that moment, and he talks about it, at that moment, I felt like I was playing an opponent. And there was something that emerged from this, you know, process of churning through numerical possibilities for the next move, where something unexpected happened. And something that surprised him and that surprised, you know, chess aficionados. And that kind of thing will begin to happen.
The ghost in the machine.
And we'll start going, what's that? You know, where does that come from?
Well, Eric, I really want to thank you for joining us. I really want to highly recommend the book, Technosis. The topics that I have listed here that I wanted to get to, Roswell, aliens, apocalypticism, Teilhard de Chardin, globalism, the glass bead game. I mean, your book is worth several PhDs, in my opinion. So I hope that you get far more acclaim for it. And people can find it at www.levity.com, and there's also links from the Change Surfer website to Eric Davis's work. Thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS-FM at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. If you want to learn more about radical democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about this show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. Also, check out past and future shows and myriad relevant links at the website, www.changesurfer.com.